Coming up on Life is a Festival.
You know, I used to say that the musicians were the gateway drug. The main stage act was the hook. You're like, oh, that's why you came. But little did you know, walking back from that amazing show, you stumble across some thing that you've like, what is this? And that was where I lived. I lived in the in-between spaces, the shenanigan spaces, the interactive space where you got to participate and do something because we created basically a vehicle. A lot of us are very lost in so many ways. And so humor and comedy and fun are really one of the safest places for people to actually be. And in that, you can have an epiphany, you can have a transformational moment, and you can learn something about yourself because all of a sudden your guard is all down and you were surprised by just pure joy.
Hello, my friends and fellow travelers. Welcome back to Life is a Festival, the podcast about things that make your life more like a festival. Sometimes it is about festival things. Sometimes it is about things that make me feel like I'm living at a festival. Sometimes it's about something I might have stumbled upon in some dark corner of some strange playground somewhere. But I want to bring it to you. Today's episode is about shenanigans. Say it with me and do a little spirit fingers. Shenanigans. Shenanigans is what muggles call immersive experience design. And who better to teach us about immersive experience design than the man, the myth, the legend who you may have never heard of, although you likely have if you've been in this space for a while, Mr. Drumroll, please, Tyler Hansen. Did you do the drum roll? I said that pretty fast. I don't know if you had time to do it. Should we try it again? Drum roll, please. Mr. Tyler Hansen. Tyler Hansen is the creator of Culture House, which was the first ever agency that actually represented these festival Imagineers on the show. We talk about the importance of humor for survival, and Tyler tells us what, in fact, is a shenanigan. And then we do a whole magical mystery tour of the history of these shenanigans, from the circus to vaudeville to Dada to beatniks and diggers to the death of the hippie and all the way through Cacophony Society to Burning Man. We talk about how Tyler became a possibility artist and created Culture House. And then, as an example of an extraordinary piece of shenanigans, we talk about something called the Chapel of the Golden Promise, which I had the great privilege of experiencing at an event not long ago. Tyler tells us the ingredients of a good shenanigan. And finally, we end our long and quite playful conversation with the goal of a shenanigan, the whole point of it. I've wanted to have Tyler on the show for a long time, and as I am writing a book on these matters, I wanted to go deep on shenanigans, and so I was going to have a call with Tyler to talk about it because he's obviously the guy. And I thought, well, gosh, that's quite selfish of me not to share it with you, you who have been following along this program, you who may very well work at a festival or very well have been transformed by one, possibly during someone's shtick. Maybe, you know, it allowed you to see some other facet of yourself that you were able to take home into the world with you. The fine art of the shenanigan is so very important to our culture, and there really isn't anyone better than Tyler Hansen to talk about it. So Tyler Hansen is a renowned cultural engineer. He's dedicated 2 decades to orchestrating innovative projects worldwide. He has been pivotal in the inception and success of numerous startups, art shows, festivals, and real estate ventures, earning recognition as a producer, creative director, curator, and advocate for transformative experiences. Tyler founded Culture House, a groundbreaking consulting agency, in 2008, creating unparalleled art experiences by connecting pioneering artists and ideas with integrated live events. And now here he is, my friend and soon to be yours, Tyler Hansen. Recording in progress. actual recording is higher quality. This is Tyler Hansen here on the program. Welcome to today's podcast with Christina Broccoli. Welcome.
Hi, Christina Broccoli. How are you today?
Christina Broccoli is what David Block called himself when we did a show on BMIR. Christina Broccoli is a really great name for a middle-aged radio presenter.
Hi. Hello,
I'm Christina Broccoli. And today we're just going to be learning a lot about yarn. I bet you thought all yarn was the same. Guess what? It's not.
Spin a yarn. Make some yarn.
Make some yarn. Tyler Hansen, you're familiar with the program. You know how it goes?
I am.
You have chats?
Yeah.
This is such great timing. I've been thinking about having you on the show for some time. And now I need your knowledge for my book. I need it. And we were going to have a call to talk about it. And then I was like, wait a minute. Why don't I just open source this to everyone who listens to my show? And the timing is great. This is a good time for us to do a lighthearted, art-focused episode. And maybe it won't get lighthearted. Maybe this experience design will be like, fucked up. But I think it's going to be a zesty time. Do you have any hopes or dreams, any deep desires for this particular program on this particular day?
I would say that hopefully at the end there, if somebody was listening to this who was always wondering what goes on behind the scenes to make such interesting and interactive fun times, comes away understanding a little bit more of why folks do that and what its impact on the world has been and can string those things together. But mostly, I think, hopefully it'll put a smile on people's faces and maybe inspire somebody to do something.
I like a smile on a face and a little do something inspiration. Makes me happy.
Awesome.
Tyler Hansen, my friend and an inspiration and someone who has been a mentor in the festival space for me, welcome to Life is a Festival.
Boom, boom, boom. Woohoo. Wait, this is a festival?
Life is a Festival. This is like a weird interlude. This is like a purgatory between one and the next one. Yeah, we're in the liminal zone.
In between. The in-between festival. For the longest time, my life was nothing but one festival after the other. So I always have appreciated the name Life is a Festival. I feel like I lived that for a very long time.
Well, that's part of why you're an appropriate guest for the show. And not only have you lived a life of a festival, but you've created the kinds of experiences that people consider iconic to festivals when we are looking at the deeper, richer, interactive, artistic experiences beyond a musical performance, which can be somewhat of a consumer experience. Mm-hmm. Not always, but often with a stage performance, it's very much consuming the art in front of you. You specialize in art that's deeply and richly participatory and even a little mind-fucking at times. And that's, I think, a lot of times when people come back from one of these incredible experiences and they're like, it was transformational. Okay, well, what was transformational? When I did the thing, when I had to pick up the phone and answer the phone, and then all of a sudden I was part of the bit. And then I realized that I have these capacities that I never thought I had before. People will often come away being so thrilled that they were part of the bit. So you are a master at making people part of the bit. So today, Tyler Hansen, you get to be part of my bit.
Woohoo!
That's going to be your answer to every question. Woohoo! I need to say nothing more.
The bit is the whole point, in my opinion, of what makes for that real experience. And, you know, I used to say that the musicians were the gateway drug. The main stage act was the hook. You're like, oh, that's why you came. But little did you know, walking back from that amazing show, you stumble across some thing that you've, what is this? And that was where I lived. I lived in the in-between spaces and the shenanigan spaces, the interactive space where you got to participate and do something because we created basically a vehicle for you to come and be engaged. So yeah, I think the transformation idea is such an interesting thing. And I always equated that to a lot of us are very lost in so many ways. And so humor and comedy and fun are really one of the safest places for people to actually be. And in that, you can have an epiphany, you can have a transformational moment, and you can learn something about yourself, because all of a sudden your guard is all down and you haven't had any expectations for anything. You were surprised by just pure joy. I got really interested in that because that was the funnest part for me personally. And I always love and still love making people laugh. And it's also one of the hardest things to do in a lot of ways, because it's comedy, and comedy has to be on the right timing, and comedy has to be in the right moment, and comedy has to have all these things that make it funny. And if it doesn't have one ingredient, often it doesn't work. And so I started really doing shenanigans, I think, from day one when I was a kid. And I threw my first house parties, and I decided that we were going to make a fake alcoholic batch of Sex on the Beach with no alcohol and serve it to the party and sit back and watch and see what happened. And everybody pretended they were drunk. And all the same things happened while people are drunk, but not drunk. It's like people slept with people, people got in fights, people tripped and stumbled and fell. And I was so amazed at that, that I think I never turned back. I was like, oh, well, what else can we do? What other prompt can we give somebody?
Tyler, we're going to talk about a lot of different experiences over the course of our conversation today. But just as a way of starting to begin to surface some of these elements of what you've referred to as shenanigans, also referred to as immersive experience design, I want to bring up a recent immersive experience that I think was really masterfully executed. And I'd love to talk to the person who put it on. This recent Burning Man experience, where you and I both were, I know because I saw you at the luminous front porch. How did they come up with the rain, man? How did they decide that they were going to hit us with that storm right when people were trying to leave, right when the weekend warriors wanted their big burn? Talk about masterful, immersive experience design. The Burning Man 2023 flood is up there in terms of some of the greatest experience design I've ever had. It brought us all together in this compelling way. We reached new heights. We learned things about ourselves.
Yeah. I heard there was a conspiracy that the climate activist actually triggered it. So to make us really understand what's coming.
And do you think we really did understand? Or do you think we're just like, meh?
I think everything's changed forever. I don't think you can go back from that. And there's nothing like key ingredient to immersive experience. Everybody experiencing one element of the same thing. Rain is like one of those things where you really can't do anything about it. You can yell at it. You can hate it. You can love it. You can play in the mud. You can do whatever. But like, no matter what, everybody is being rained on. And my whole line from Burning Man was like, we might all be in the same storm. Definitely not in the same boat. You know, depending on what camp you were at. You know, I love how everybody kicked in and became radically communal. The communal aspect of supporting everybody was like instantaneous almost. And part of the key ingredients of the design, because that was basically given to you as the menu. Hey, what do I do here? Oh, I do these things. But yeah, wow, what a crazy trip to see everybody have to experience the same thing and survive. I don't know.
And play in some cases.
And play.
Once our Maslow's baseline needs are met, our security, we fed people. Like at my camp, we fed people. We took care of some refugees. Then it was like, what do we do? How do we play? And first night, we went with a party and made that happen, like lurched our way through a party. But then the second night after the rain, when it was still too muddy to do anything, we did an open mic night in our opera house, which was confined by everything around it. And there wasn't other music that was competing, and it created a certain kind of coziness. So I like the fact that when your canvas changes, you know, we all had to paint with watercolors.
Totally. And everything was stripped away. There was no more schedule. You couldn't travel fast. What do? I hang out with my neighbors. I make fun inside my camp. And humor is always the thing that everybody of all the history books will say is the survival mechanism in so much too. How do you survive in times of challenge? And if you're able to laugh at it, then you're going to make it.
So I love the idea of this extraordinary power of humor, that it gets us through difficult times, that it can help us break through a sort of transformational kind of experience. Like when there's a wall, humor can kind of disarm and move us through in a certain way. And I think humor is a key feature. I want to talk a little bit about some other key features to the kind of immersive experience that you refer to as shenanigans. So to start with, why do you call them shenanigans? Maybe you could briefly describe one to give the audience an idea of what is a shenanigan.
Shenanigans, well, got to give a shout out to Kevin Cochin, RIP, one of the founders of Symbiosis and my founding partner in Culture House, who really didn't like the words that were being thrown around. None of us who were festival producers ever really resonated with the words transformation or immersive. So shenanigans was our word that we said, this is what we're doing, actually. And to give a brief example of one of the best shenanigans that we ever pulled off, we put on a fake flat earth panel at Symbiosis in 2016 or 17. And we promoted it as if it was a legit flat earth panel. And we had both sides of the spectrum yelling at us and applauding us, which was terrifying because we
got flat earth, actual flat earthers applauding you, and then people who are like offended by everything, offended.
Pissed. And mind you, just before, a few months before at Lightning in a Bottle, there was a flat earth panel proper with David Avakalva Wolf, and there was such huge blowback that the Dolab and folks were kind of caught flat footed because they didn't realize that it had happened and was booked, and so many people were upset. So we orchestrated a fake flat earth panel with a whole cast of characters, and it was absolute mayhem. And we also then orchestrated pro flat earther performances from the Take Three community and anti flat earthers from other groups. So we had created this whole shenanigan with dozens of people and then proper characters to be there. Me and Benja were flat earth tour guides, tech bros who had figured out how to go to the edge of earth with Tesla boats and could show people. And we were booked out for the next 4 years, and it was $1 million a ride or whatever. And just the level of detail that went into that was just insane. And really, you know, in some ways it's like, ha, this is our own joke that we created for the world. But I highly encourage everybody to look up the flat earth panel on Symbiosis from whatever year that was, 2016, 17, something like that. And one of my greatest achievements. And Kevin Cochin, God bless him, was so good at this. And the reason that we tried to do these things was really to, again, to make lightheartedness, to make commentary of the time, to translate it. And I think that if you look back and through the history of all of the world, that's what comedy has always been doing. And comedy and artists and creatives have always been the great translators and the great showmen, show peoples of the world, to be able to give some sort of context to what the fuck is going on in the world. Shenanigans, really, to me, it goes back to the Merry Pranksters, it goes back to the Beatniks, it goes back to the Bohemians, it goes back to all these folks that I must have some old DNA, old soul blood through, because I've never really been any different. I always loved comedy. I always loved making people laugh. I always loved supporting and creating containers where people could laugh. And to make fun of something that is hard, or to make fun of something that is confusing, whatever it is, I don't know. The one side note that I'll have on that shenanigan, I just remember, me and Benja were taking a Lyft ride into San Francisco, and the guy who was driving us definitely was like right out the gate a conspiracy theorist. And he said something like, we didn't land on the moon. I was like, no, bro, you can have everything else, but you can't take away the moon. And then he somehow starts talking about Symbiosis in the flat earth panel, and he's like really excited to go to it. And then me and Benja leaned in and looked, and we're like, yeah, so we're actually on that panel. And he lost his lid. we fucked with him all the way to the end. And he truly believed that we were legitimately flat earthers who did believe in the moon landing. And that, I think that experience like really change the perspective, like, wow, what happens when you put things online and people anyway. So the point of a shenanigan, the point of comedy, the point of vaudeville, the point of the circus, the point of puppets, the point of the court jester, the point of all of these mediums of humor throughout time have always been a place where you could say the really hard stuff in a way that it would resonate, in a way that it was safe for a moment, not always safe for a jester if they said the wrong thing, and would be able to cut through the noise to make the point. And that, for whatever reason, has always been in my DNA of trying to express this reality in the world, which is not always that easy. So in some ways, it's also a sense of survival to make laughter. And it's like, well, it can't be that bad if we're laughing about it, you know? Trying.
Well, Tyler, you kind of fucked up because you started talking about history, and I am just the biggest history nerd. And when I say you fucked up, I mean for the audience. Like, I'm sorry, listeners, but we're going to do history now. It's Tyler's fault. Tyler's the guy who raised his hand and said, "You did not. There's no homework. You did that. That's what you just did by bringing up cool history shit that now I'm going to make you talk about." I'm really interested in the evolution of these kind of immersive experiences. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily just things that on the face of it are playful and fun. Things that like mess with you and often will get you to a certain place. I'd love to just walk through the history of shenanigans. You'd mentioned vaudeville and the circus. Let's talk about the circus and what immersive experience design meant in the American frontier.
Yeah. The circus, by definition, is one of America's greatest products. It's culturally was the thing that brewed out of this frontier universe, this frontier world. And the circus can go back all the way to, some would argue, the very first circuses were actually the gladiator, you know, expositions. The gladiators and the Colosseum and all that were not just men killing men and men killing beasts, but also showing all sorts of horses running around and technology of chariots and whatnot. But the American circus really comes out of this new frontier, and nobody knows exactly who was or where did and how it started, but it began as a form of entertainment and a form of showcasing all these different things, which also ties into where we get the World's Fairs, which once the train comes along in America and the circus is put onto the train, then that explodes this whole movement of big top tents and being able to go and see another world. And so much of that world was defined by a formula that came about. And you have an announcer, and you have the whole circus that comes in and they show everything. And then you have the clowns who are like stumbling around constantly. The clowns have always been the narrator, like the translator inside that, even all the way to the Cirque du Soleil. I used to joke all the time about Cirque du Soleil. There's a kid who gets lost and he finds a clown and the clown helps him out through the whole story. Like, that was so many of those. That's the simple formula. Of course, Cirque du Soleil has so many other versions, but the origins of that movement of circus and that new form of entertainment, which we did not have Shakespeare in the U.S. We did not have so much because we were so young and we didn't have big buildings and hundreds of years of theater being built and all that stuff. We built temporary tents, which America was all about temporarily moving along because we were all on this frontier. And so like the literally towns and cities and places are popping up left, right, and center and disappearing as part of that whole process. And so the circus takes us, you know, really is like early 1800s into the late 1900s and still today, like it continues on, but the heyday of the circus and when we finally get into the Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey's and all that stuff, the huge operations and really kind of like World's Fairs smushed into a touring tent. And if you think about the train as a vehicle of information, it's kind of was like the internet bringing all this stuff to the world. World's Fairs come online in like 1860, 1870, 1880. And those were really like, that was how you went and saw the world, all these collections of colonizers and all their stolen stuff to show you, you know, how amazing they were. So it's true.
Classic.
It is true. But that's America and all the stuff when the World's Fair happens in Chicago. That is America's coming out party. But it's the largest city that's ever created temporarily. They have 1 million people who show up for it. And so many things are invented, including the Ferris wheel. And all this stuff, the Ferris wheel, by the way, was to out-Eiffel the Eiffel Tower. That's why they built the Ferris wheel. It was the largest piece of casted metal ever created. And they had to make new train tracks to be able to ship it to the place. But that whole expose of showcasing all this stuff was deeply rooted already in what America had been doing. So that was like a culmination of everything. And then from there, all sorts of things happen. But at the same time, then you get this like 1890s vaudeville scene that comes out of all of this world of America, which is also extremely American. And vaudeville was always taking mundane or normal or basic stuff and turning it into light. It was relatable. That's what vaudeville was always about. It was the baselines of comedy. That's where we, in some ways, invent modern day comedy by having vaudeville artists, and so many things come out of vaudeville in a short time. Simultaneously, you have in other parts of the world, Moulin Rouge in Paris, and you know, the wards and what's going on in South Africa, in Cape Town and stuff like that, all this like culmination of mixture. And often the thing that is forgotten in this is that it's this great hybrid place because everybody was coming to it. And what's the key ingredient? Artist. Artist. Call it whatever you want to call it. It's artists who are coming together and sharing all this stuff. And sometimes it was funny, but sometimes it was just poignant, right? And from, I can trace from vaudeville, you then get to Dada. And Dada is basically a political statement that a group of theater and an artist, a small group, basically write a declaration and say, all words are war, because it's the end of World War I and everything is a disaster. And they say, all words are war, and we are no longer going to make art using words. And so we were going to make Dada. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. I'm not going to say any blah, 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 because all words are war. All words are war of propaganda, and we're going to make art that don't use words. And all of the crazy shenanigans that come out of Dada by giving that prompt. What's the crazy is like Dada is the first manifesto. There's been like 120 manifestos, but Dada was the one who like puts the flag in the ground and says, this is it. And some, it resonates with everybody and it travels around. And I'm always fascinated by those types of little experiences because it's always a small group of folks who cause the ripple in this world. And those, it's special place, it's special time, it's a special meaning, whatever it is, it's always a small group that somehow have this influence and allows for it to grow. And from vaudeville, you can go into bohemians. And from bohemians, you can go into beatniks. And from beatniks, you can go into hipster or to diggers, to go into hippies, to go into punk rock, to go into cacophony, etc.
Wait, hold on a second. Wait, yeah. What are diggers? I don't know diggers. What are diggers?
So the digger movement was actually the thing that started before the hippie. So in San Francisco, the digger movement was basically the ones who declared the summer of love. The digger store on Haight-Ashbury was a free store. And these were the counterculture folks who came out of the beatnik, you know, movement of artists. Beatnik just means artist. Groups of artists hanging out, and here's your title, and somebody else calls them, like Jack Kerouac was like, I never meant to call ourselves beatniks. You guys did, you know, the media did, everybody else. So the diggers are like the in-between movement of San Francisco. Everybody should understand this because they also declared the Summer of Love in 1968, 69. And by the end, they said, this is fucked and the hippie movement is dead. And they actually had a funeral for the hippie and they marched a coffin down Haight Street and went to into Golden Gate Park and buried a coffin to say the hippie movement is over.
Was it the Altamont Speedway Festival where someone died? Because that's often considered the end of the hippie movement, was that festival.
That coincides, but long before that, all the kids showed up. So you had all these teenagers show up to San Francisco to descend across the country and to San Francisco, and it was a shit show. Kids are sleeping on streets. Parents are driving across the country to find their kids. And it's just a complete disaster because the influx of San Francisco they couldn't handle it. They didn't know what to do with it. And so they basically, the leaders of the digger movement were like, it's over. Hey, sorry, not the right thing. Not to end what they were trying to do, but just to end the declaration. I always think that's really hilarious because so many things that have longstanding withstanding the times are often put to rest by the folks who started it, you know, but sometimes things become bigger than what they actually were. When you go from beatnik to digger to hippie to punk rock in a lot of ways, and specifically if you're looking in San Francisco and the counterculture movement of everything that happens in there, and then you get to the Suicide Club in the 70s, and the Emperor Norton crew. What Suicide Club hosts the Emperor Norton Day. Emperor Norton, for those who don't know, was a man who lived in San Francisco, who was a rice baron, who lost his wealth, who decided to declare himself Emperor of San Francisco. He made his own money, and he went around dressed in this emperor kind of French motif of sorts, regalia. And when he died, he lived in a small apartment, and he had been corresponding with all sorts of kings and queens and presidents across the world who he was trying to succeed California from the United States of America. He also was the first one to propose the Bay Bridge from Oakland to Treasure Island to San Francisco. He made declarations, proclamations, and put them up. Anyway, what a character, 1800s. He was part of the vaudeville scene and everything like that. The Suicide Club are the ones who start having Emperor Norton Day. But Cacophony Society brews out of that. It's this whole shenanigans, Merry Prankster, this crew of folks who were counterculture revolutionaries. They're pieing politicians. There's still a law in San Francisco that says a pie truck cannot be within X amount of feet or something like that to a politician or a public building, stuff of that nature. But anyway, I think those things are really, because it's always the same kind of these meandering threads, and we give them different names, but they're really in the essence the same archetype. Response. Yeah, archetype and response. And then we've always had them. And I think, you know, in some ways though, also, they are the most important they're the most important artists in our world, because they are the beehive punchers. They are the anthill kickers. They're the ones who say, is that the line? Okay, I'm stepping over it. Just to show you where the line is, to make sure that you know where the line is. And that's what artists have always done, right? And we don't get Burning Man without Cacophony or all of the rest that comes before it, which is always something that's been interesting to me.
For the listeners who aren't aware, can you give the Burning Man Cacophony tie-in? I'm aware of the Zone Trips and some mutual founders, but can you give us that thread for the young burners out there who are like, I don't believe any of this applies to me. I do acid in the desert. I'm the first one who ever did it.
Basically, again, in that long thread of these folks who are doing these immersive experiences, long before anybody thought of them, the Cacophony Society in late 70s, early 80s, and we must refer to Danger Ranger, Michael, who was one of the folks who was organizing these gatherings. And the gatherings would be like, we're going to do high tea society on the Bay Bridge. And so basically imagine that there were flyers that were posted around town and little zines put out by these folks who were organizing these unique, often costumed rendezvous points. And so one of them was that they would do high tea and dress up in turn of the century, 1800 regalia, and go on to the Golden Gate Bridge and have tea and have this thing. So like at said time, at said date, meet here, and then we'll walk onto the bridge and go out. One of the first ones that I ever heard of the Cacophony Society, living in Reno, Nevada as a kid, there was SantaCon. And SantaCon was organized by Cacophony. And basically, it was like, oh, let's all rendezvous at the mall in downtown San Francisco, but get on to the BART dressed as Santa and bring some coal. And we're going to go hand out coal at the mall. And so all of these Santas descending on all the lines coming into San Francisco. And it really was, though, this is the thing. It was a anti-consumerism, not protest, activation. It was a commentary on society back then. And now, you know, and this is the thing, how things devolve over time, because folks who do SantaCon across the country now are really just going to bars and getting drunk dressed as Santa, you know. But every time I see like the zombie walk and this one and that one, I'm like, ha ha ha. the inspiration for this came from these freaking knuckleheads over here who decided to do a social commentary shenanigan on anti-consumerism long before anybody even knew what the fuck that meant. And so that's also one of the things with folks of this nature, of people who are doing these things. These are long tendrils of what is to come. If you can find them, if you see them, if you know them, then you can see that thread. And to just put a pin in the Cacophony Society, so Cacophony Society is doing these really outlandish get-togethers where people dress in costume and meet in one spot and do something. Simple, as far as that's the baseline of it. They just consistently did it. And because of that, because people were doing fun, different, interesting things, these people met, including Larry Harvey. And so the reason that you get Burning Man in the desert is because the crew of people who are hanging out doing weird stuff in San Francisco burn a man on a beach in Baker Beach, and that is so cool that they do it again. And then and everybody thinks that's really cool, and they come back and do it again, and they do it again, and then to the point where like Willie Brown, the mayor of San Francisco, is like, "Hell no, this is too big, you can't do this," and they kick him off the beach and declare you can't do that ever again. And so there's a special person who I won't say his name, who had already gone out to the Black Rock Desert. He's the wizard behind the curtain who nobody would ever know. He was like, "Hey guys,
wait, what do you mean you're not going to say his name?"
He would never want that.
Okay, well, at least it's nice to know there is someone. I figured there was some, you know, there was one,
and this is the other interesting thing. There often is only one. And so this person, who we will not name, had gone out to the Black Rock Desert some years before, I think for a land speed race, where they drive cars as fast as possible before they fly. That's this car is the fastest car on land, and it doesn't fly, you know. It was like, it'd be really cool to go out there. And so the initial going out there was, you had the ingredient, we're going to go out to the desert and build this wooden structure of a man. But the rest of everything else that came out was nothing but shenanigans. Was nothing but ridiculous, weird, crazy shit. Do it because nobody's going to stop you from doing it. And the only real rule was, don't kill anyone. Don't hurt them either. But as long as that's cool, we're good. And so all of the freaks and geeks and artists and creatives who came from San Francisco and went out to the desert to start Burning Man were out there in a show of defiance to do whatever the fuck they wanted to do at that time. And that spirit is still inside of Burning Man. But that is, if you didn't give a shit about the history of Burning Man, that's why you need to understand that, because that's where it came from. It didn't come from all this deep meaning and all of the transformation. No. It came because we could go out there and nobody would stop us. I went in 1995. So, you know, what I saw going to this place was total mayhem, total chaos. It was dangerous. It was also wildly fun. And there were so many different weird little things. And there were only like 2,000 people there. What the fuck? Pound for pound, that's what I always said. Back in the day, you had more artists than participants. It was reversed. Because everybody who was going out there was an artist. And the people who were showing up were like, we're looky-loos. And what that did was inspire a young mind like me to be like, oh, well, I could do something too. Because why would we just hang around here and just watch this stuff? Fuck, nobody's going to stop me. I can make a thing.
Okay, Tyler. So let's talk about you making things. So you go to Burning Man in 1995. Mm-hmm. You'd already... through parties where you were serving people not booze, which I love that for you. I really love that for you. I'm interested in two things, and mm-hmm. they're both really big questions, so we can talk about them over time. One mm-hmm. is the process of designing a shenanigan, because right. something that is great and something that is very professional always looks effortless. But if you're mm-hmm. designing something where there's a lot of participation, the participation could make it go certain ways, you have to devote a lot of budget to having a lot of different storylines. There's a lot of stuff that goes into it. So mm-hmm. I want to talk about the complexities of creating these kinds of things. And I'm really curious how it became a career, like how it became something where it's like, oh, I actually make money doing this.
Totally. So born and raised in Reno, Nevada, raised by a single mother in my teenage years, a single mother who was a teacher. Which meant that my mom took the summer off and went and played for herself, leaving me behind to run the house, leaving us, me and my friends, which I had a nice, fun crew, to be able to throw parties. And basically, my mom also just wanted everybody to be in the same space rather than going out and doing the stupid stuff in cars and drinking and blah, blah, blah. So I always had this safe space for people to come to. And I was the one that I was that dude in high school who threw all the parties. And my crew and me, and some of which I'm, you know, two of my best friends are these folks. But basically, we got bored with throwing the same parties over and over again. And like I said about serving a drink, a non-alcoholic drink, telling everybody there was alcohol was just like the gateway drug. And we then started just creating themes around it. Themed parties.
I did theme parties, mushroom tea parties. Yeah. Love a good theme. Yeah. Love a good theme and some psychedelic drugs. All you really need for a good time.
Well, and a little hook, right? You know, like, oh, this is, you know, I always say, are you bored or are you boring? And so when we were in high school, I don't think we were ever bored. We were just always trying to come up with new things to do. And that was like my little tear into it. I had no fucking clue what else I was going to do. And then when I was 18, I went to my first Dead show. And at first I just went to the parking lot and that was like peeling back the tie-dye. I was like, what the hell is this? And then I went to the Autzen Stadium in Eugene, Oregon, which held 70,000 people, but there were 300,000 people who came to the show. And the shenanigans, the fun, and all of that was happening outside of the show for the 230,000 people who didn't get in absolutely blew my mind. And then the first day I was just outside, didn't have a ticket. The second day I went in and I'm standing on the floor and looking at all this stuff and watching this show. And I said, whatever this is, I want to do this. And that was my commitment. And from there, I just continued down that path of producing shows. I wound up in Seattle, Washington via Fishing in Alaska. And Seattle in the 90s was this magical time of just all sorts of kooks and crazies because everybody was descending post-grunge to come and be in Seattle. And I hooked up with an amazing human, Chris McMullen, who was the first artist I knew, who I grew up with here in Reno. And then he had moved there. And then he connected to Greg Lundgren, who had created an art studio space collective. I don't know. Shout out to Greg Lundgren, who created Vital Five Senses. And I was working in music and doing music, and I was really burnt out on it and all the follies of the music business. I created a streaming media site called Giant Radio and was signing up bands to get online, to put their music online so people could listen to it. And then I went to my first Vital Five show, which was Greg had gotten this lease on a bank, and he did this anti-Christmas show or something like that. I played Santa and sat in a bed naked. I was creepy Santa inside a bed taking pictures with people. And like everything that was there was like cardboard suits and like water essence of, you know, spray. Everything was anti-consumerism, but fun. It was all hilarious. Everything in there was hilarious. And then this one show that actually flipped my entire lid was that we did this thing called the Immortality Clinic. And the Immortality Clinic was this fake setup where you could go and pay $20 and get immortalized. And you basically went through an immersive experience, a step-by-step interview process. And then you came out with your picture and you got announced over the loudspeakers, John is now immortalized. And everybody was like, yay, clap, clap, clap. And there were doctors who were dressed up because the whole thing that Jason Puccinelli had come up with was science versus God. And basically that was this kind of juxtaposition. So he made these huge motifs of the Last Supper with Jesus in the middle, but all doctors looking at him, and or a doctor doing an incision looking for the heart of Jesus. And we were protesting because WTO had just happened. There's like 50 people who were part of this show. We're outside protesting. People need to die. People need to die. My picture was in the newspaper with me standing next to an old person, and the sign says, old people suck. And this was repeatedly happening and going on, and we were producing all of our shows and doing all this stuff. And so that really just set me off. And in a lot of ways, because this is like after I'd gone to Burning Man, I was constantly trying to bring in and integrate this like crazy chaotic, you know, Burning Man spirit into things. And everybody who I went to tell, like, oh, have you been to Burning Man? And I spent years bringing hundreds of people to Burning Man in the 90s and into the early 2000s. And always trying to do this juxtaposition and everything. And then I did this show called Secluded, which was an art show in the woods. And it was brilliantly done. You went to the art gallery, which was also called Secluded, and you got on a school bus and they drove you about 2 hours north into a rainforest where they had curated all of these artists to put all of this art into a rainforest. And you basically were kicked off the bus, given a map and told, go here, go there. There'll be breakfast in the morning. Good luck. And it just totally blew my mind because, oh, you can put art anywhere. And so I got really fixated on the idea of like taking art and put it into unconventional places. So I wound up moving to Austin, Texas, and going to Albert Deloach, who had bought a piece of property called the Austin Enchanted Forest. And the moment I walked down there, I said, we must do an art show here. And that was how I brewed Art Outside. And Art Outside was a festival that I co-created with a great, wonderful group of people. And that was really what set me on the path. And from there, I started producing shows because everybody knew me from Art Outside, which was also part of South by Southwest. And we were bringing all of these artists in from all over the country and also had the access to literally 1,700 bands. And so we did a multi-day festival inside a little piece of forest that was basically in downtown Austin, Texas, this bohemian grove of sorts, and really magical place that we transformed into this fantasy land. And we did all sorts of crazy things in there. We were constantly creating things. We created VIP areas that nobody could go into and stuff like that, you know, like all this social commentary on the state of things, and had all sorts of different performances come and go for there. And so because of that, then that was how I was introduced to all these different things. And I was traveling around the country constantly going and doing different shows. And like Zingalati, the cruise ship where everybody came together and met, that was a huge moment in time in 2006 or whatever it was. And the culmination of all of that really was then when I created Culture House in 2008, because I was like, wow, there's nobody representing this really interactive, immersive, creative art. Who's doing that? And people were calling me all the time to say, hey, we want this interactive, immersive, creative. We want a Tesla coil. We want a trapeze artist. We want this. We want that. And so that, for me, was kind of the aha moment. And also seeing a lot of my artist friends get fucked over or not, like nobody knowing how to manage them, deal with them, all this stuff. So I turned it into a full-time, lifetime gig. And all I really ever wanted to do was just be able to give voice to reason to this amazing movement. But I also said, this is going to be a movement. This is going to be an art thing. This is a thing that the world is, you know, hungry for. And now here we are, still look at all of this, you know, amazing art that has come from it. And finally, slowly starting to get the recognition of, and it's been called many things, but at the end of the day, when art does that little tick over, when artists come up like, haha, we're doing this little different thing, that's always how things slowly shuffle over into what is then kind of a movement. You know, I was touring around the country. I was doing 16 shows a year around the world, and all of it was to basically work within these really out there, oddball, weird, like, this is not normal stuff, because that's what everybody wanted, but nobody knew how to really manage or deal with or produce. So in that, somebody, my friend Justinian Morton, said, you're really like a possibility artist. And I was like, yeah, I'm a possibility artist. That's what I've been doing, making things possible, which is often not that easy and can lead to severe uncertainty about the world. And you always need to come back to your friends and family and get a hug and say, you did good, and you can do good again. Yeah, there's a lot. Whoa!
Tyler, it's a beautiful story, and there's stuff in that story that I actually hadn't heard before, and stuff that I didn't know about you, which is a beautiful part about doing these podcasts. I've known you for 7 or 8 years now. I admire your work. I also love the way you show up, because, you know, you are a merchant of possibility, and that also requires a certain kind of personality, a certain way of being, a certain kind of joy that is contagious. You need that, because in a sense, you are a hype man, and you're hyping these artists, and you've mentored a lot of artists. You've mentored people who've gone on to do really compelling, edge-pushing work. So it's nice to hear a bit more about you. I want to get a little bit more granular design. And to do that, I'm going to tell a brief story about an experience that you were involved in that I had recently as an observer, as a spectator, as someone involved, and why I thought it was so rad. Mm. And we're going to use that to kind of just unpack the inside of a shenanigan. Mm-hmm. And what we're going to talk about is the Chapel of the Golden Promise. Mm-hmm. And I want to talk about it from the perspective of an attendee. Mm-hmm. I didn't know what it was. Mm-hmm. It was part of it was a festival, it was an event where different artists took over different rooms and created whatever they wanted to. And there's a high irreverence to this particular community, a lot of weird stuff, a lot of like boundary pushing. Mm-hmm. And so I expect nothing less than greatness from the Chapel of the Golden Promise. But essentially, we were led into the inside of a chapel. It felt like a congregation. And we were subjected to essentially what came down to a musical, like full-on musical numbers, like a huge performance. And it was unclear what the Golden Promise was. There was like something about the drip was very important. So it was kind of building like, Drip Trip. What is the Golden Promise? What is this thing? And then you had volunteers who were people who had been chosen before. So they didn't come directly out of the audience, but they were chosen before. They knew what they were getting into. Mm-hmm. But as a piece of interactive art, these were other attendees. They weren't involved in the production at all. So there were people who got to volunteer and they were briefed on what would happen. But essentially you performed a marriage. And when I say you, I mean the entire group that put this together, because I know it was a lot of different artists working on it, performed a marriage, essentially a golden promise. And the golden promise was you revealed two toilets and the guests who we thought were getting married got up and peed in the toilets in front of all of us. And the pee went through these pipes. We watched it go through these pipes. It mingled, so the pee mingled, and then was delivered into these amulets that you could then, these little potions that you could then wear around your neck. And indeed, you could then, you then were hustled us into the gift shop where we could buy vials of this combined pee. And for me,
that all happened.
What an incredible thing to do to an audience, in that it's like the reveal of the toilets. It's, oh, that's what they're going to do. And then later on in the event, there are people who are wearing these little necklaces with these files where you're just wearing someone's combined pee. I mean, it was really a class A shenanigan. And it was so detailed. There were these highly choreographed songs, this whole thing. We were all really engaged throughout. I'd say the whole thing probably lasted 15, 20 minutes. Yep. Not sure how long the show run was.
Yep.
But I remember laughing harder at that and being more astounded. I had more wow from that, from anything else from that whole event. As I was just like, oh, they're doing that. So... The Chapel of the Golden Promise, let's look at that as a kind of shenanigan. And let's just talk a little bit about what it means to design something like that, to design audience participation. In this case, it seemed like you controlled for certain outcomes. You were talking to people who were participating, but there were legitimate participants who you were challenging to push their edges to pee in front of people. Tell me how that shenanigan was designed, how it all came together. Give me a brief autopsy on the Chapel of the Golden Promise.
Well, first, we must give a shout out to the creator of the Chapel of the Golden Promise, which is Ever Wolverton, who has been doing the musical at this show that we do not name.
He did The Gay Communist from the Future as well, right?
Correct.
Where it was like an opera that you ended up with a butt plug in. You ended up having to put a butt plug in someone at the end of it.
Yes. So Evan is a mad genius. One of my greatest honors is to just help mad geniuses and within the details. And most shenanigans really start with a question. What is the most intimate thing that he could put two people on stage doing that wouldn't be over the top, like wouldn't be too much, would be just enough. And that just enough for him was like, what if I put two people getting promised on toilets in front of an audience and they peed into them? That's the prompt, right? And from there, Evan is also a musical composer and just mad wicked genius. So not only did he come up with all of this, he wrote all of the songs, and then he came up with the choreography for all of it with the group. And shout out to my lady, Galen Dorian, because I never would have done this show without her. And I was like, wait a minute, we're doing what? Well, I don't know about this, honey. And little did I really understood, because basically the set and setting, the prompt, these are all the key ingredients to making something really awesome. And there was a whole cast of crew who came together to be able to bring this show online. And this is also one of the wonderful parts of this type of community, an immersive experience design community, where you have so much different knowledge base that you can pull from. And someone can come in and, I got the lighting for you, I got the triggers. So this whole show was set inside the actual chapel of the hotel. So all of those ingredients were there. So we really didn't have to modify the space very much, because it was already this weird hotel chapel, which, why would you ever get married at this hotel? The actual view outside the window was the parking lot. But people do.
Yeah, the chapel was like amongst the regular rooms.
Yes.
It was just there happened to be one room that was
yes,
a chapel.
That
yeah, I was wondering, I was like, how did they convert that so dynamically?
Yeah.
So there was actually a chapel.
With all the chairs and all the set and setting and everything. So we did just the smallest of modifications when it really came down to it. But we, you know, we did all this lighting around the room. So lighting, sound, stage, script, audio, how the audio hits and everything. Do you have enough for speakers? Do you have the bass? You know, all that stuff. So all of that was pre-designed and preset. And then we worked furiously within the small windows of time that we had to be able to like get that thing right. And man, the whole crew is just phenomenal. I'm just a facilitator in that spot. All I do is just kind of fine tune, help and make sure that everything runs and then wind up being the maitre d' and welcoming people in, right? And sit them down. And then we hand selected each of the promisers, the promissaries. We gave them a very brief, like, you have to be cool with coming onto stage, dropping your pants and sitting there on the toilet for the whole time. That's all that they knew. And then all the audience knew is that they were coming to see some weird, wacky show. They have no clue walking into it. So that's part of the reveal, the leading up to this whole script and everything. So absolutely, that is a grade A, tip top of the line container, a safe container. We're also at a very safe space of a community that is pushing the boundaries. So like you couldn't do this show at all different. this is honestly, you know, arguably probably something that would never happen again. You know, this is a one and done reality.
Quick question. The peers, mm-hmm. they were not informed that they were going to be peeing?
No, that we gave them informed. That much. We asked them and we got their consent. Because this is a consent-driven community, which is amazing, to be able to say, are you comfortable pulling down your pants, sitting on a toilet, and peeing as part of this performance? And now, like, most everybody who said yes, they showed. I think we only had one crew who didn't show up on time or whatever. We did have one group who then jumped in because they were trying to cut the line and we didn't have the people there. And so on the spot, they joined in. And the thing was, is that we actually created a ritual. We actually created a real intimate moment. There was a song and a dance. This was a Broadway show in so many ways. This was cabaret at its finest. This was vaudeville at its finest with participants. And the thing about busking, vaudeville, anything, anytime you bring the audience on stage, you and the audience become the audience. You are the person on stage. Everybody can relate to that person on the stage, right? So you can imagine yourself. And mind you, now everybody who we invited their friends. And so now we're putting them on this extremely intimate moment with all of this hilarious comedy going on. And now we're saying, hold your hands, look deeply into your eyes, and let it flow. And then the whole reveal of this, all this coming down, mind you, the urine went down into these buckets and had little pumps, and then we pumped them both up into what was basically a modified watermelon heart that's clear. It's like how Japanese grow watermelon as hearts. So the ingenuity that went in behind all of this to make this contraption is just mind-boggling. And the things that we do for fun, that's why people will push this boundary. And man, all of the ingredients were there. And you can only hope that you can ever get one of those because so many little things could fall apart. But that show, that experience, so Evan had a couple of things. He wanted to put two people in an audience in the most intimate, safe setting that he could, pushing the boundaries of safe. And he also wanted to perform to as many people as possible because before he had been roving, you called up the music, you called them up and they came to your hotel room to perform at this party. And he was like, man, that's exhausting. I want to just do one room and stay in one spot. And we wanted to get as many people as possible through the doors as quickly as possible because a lot of times you're waiting in line and all this stuff. And so we figured that we performed to almost 1,500 of the 2,000-ish people by the end of it. And every one of those shows, we, the performers, we, the audience, everybody was in tears because they're actually saying their vows, their promises to each other, holding hands, and the music goes down. Everything kicks in and then out the door we go because of course we're going to send you to the gift shop because we got to pay for this where we sold people the urine of the promisers plus whatever else, you know, propaganda shenanigan, you know, oh, buy your hat, buy your sticker, buy your thing, which was legit to help pay for it also, by the way, because there's no budget for these things really, you know, there's a small stipend, but yeah, I love that you got to witness that. And on the highest order is that piss your pants, literally no pun intended, funny and all of the ingredients that are lined up there. And that's why I say you cannot really, at the end of the day, when you're trying to create one of these things, you have to have a key list of ingredients. And if you miss one, you better be really heavy on the others.
Those ingredients?
So again? Yeah, when you start out, I think first and foremost, like, you have an idea. Okay, I want to do this thing. I want to have people come and do something. So that idea is the genesis for most things. Sometimes you're inspired by the place that you're going to do it. But the next then is obviously the location. Where are you doing it? Because the physical space is going to confine you to what you can actually do. You can't, I want to do this, but the ceiling's too high or too low or whatever it is. So the location and then the technology. So sound, lighting, any other things that you're going to use, wizardry, video, etc. And then you're getting to your storyline, your script, your mode of experiential design, which can vary from choose your own adventure to like, we are going to make you do you're going to do this step by step. Or in this case of the chapel, like this is an audience show. So you're going to sit down, you're going to watch the show and enjoy it. And we're just going to take you on a ride, right? And then really, and this is the most challenging one, is your audience. You can never choose your audience. So in this case, you get a little bit better understanding. We didn't know if people would think this is funny. Most often, you never know if it's going to work until you do it. And you got to be okay with that. So you got to be also willing to take the leap, willing to take the risk. And also be able to improv. Don't stay concretely on the script. Don't get stuck, in your own ego and your own design. And then most importantly is your team. And being able to have that team to pull it off and being able to be a good leader. There always has to be a director. You can't direct by community design for the thing. You're like, that doesn't really come together always. But smushing all of those together is this kind of soup of ingredients. And I'm sure I'm probably missing a couple of them. But I always say this, as long as you can get a core baseline of it, then you have a good fighting chance to pulling something off of whatever the intention was. And that is not always the case. I've done shows where like they've completely fallen flat and there was nothing really to do about it. And all you can do is you can walk away and be like, aha, and think about it in post. But there's nothing better than the show when it works and there's nothing worse when it doesn't.
That's comedy.
That is.
You're either killing it or you're bombing.
Yeah.
I did one of these immersive experiences as the guy who was like put into the situation. And it was like a 1950s TV show. Uh-huh. And it was like my big, stupid, dumb wife or something like that. Uh-huh. And my job was to play a stereotypical 1950s housewife. The script was so sexist, like intensely uh-huh. sexist. I had the little apron and dress and wig and all that kind of stuff. And the bit was, it was like a film set.
Yeah,
and like
yeah.
with the cameras, the whole thing, and a live audience, and an actor who was playing like the abusive man, and I was this woman who was being denigrated in front of this audience. And the whole bit was that the audience had to like gauge whether they were okay with it or not. And if they weren't, they could start changing it. It was really pressing on people's relationship to sexism, and it was confronting to the audience in a certain way. Turned out to be like super confronting for me because I wanted to do a really good job. Mm-hmm. And I always want to do a good job, especially at a performance. But mm-hmm. to do a good job, I had to tap into sexism in me. Mm-hmm. I had to make choices to play this character that was particularly being humiliated in front of this audience. And it was such an interesting feeling because, well, first of all, I was high. So it was one of those environments.
Side note, I was high.
And it was remarkable because while it was happening, I was having a whole moral dilemma between, do I want to perform this in the way that I think is going to be the most funny, the most mm-hmm. to the thing that they're asking me to do? Mm-hmm. But I have to make certain choices, and I'm making choices to depict this woman as stupid in this mm-hmm. extremely misogynistic way. And it was really nerve-wracking. When it was all done, I was like, I think I need to not party for a bit and just be with this. Like, I need to like experience what this was like tapping into in me. Mm. I don't know that the experience of doing it, I don't know if I could pin that as transformative mm-hmm. in the way of like, I did an ayahuasca ceremony and then I held my father as a child and I was transformed in my relationship to him. I don't know that it was as linear as that, mm-hmm. but it was a confronting experience and I've thought about it a lot since. And I was like, okay, how sexist actually am I? And I guess that's like, wow. It's a kind of social commentary to challenge someone. And so I think what they were trying to do, particularly what they were trying to do to the audience, but what they were trying to do like really ended up working for me because I was like, oh, I am, and I'll just say it live on Life is a Festival, I'm more sexist than I thought I was. It's the cultural milieu for sure. And it is these TV shows from the 50s and just the way that we are the heirs of patriarchy. But what a thing.
What a thing. That reminds me, there's a thing that came out of Brazil called the Theater of the Oppressed. And the Theater of the Oppressed is basically, in some ways, what you're describing in parts of it. But basically, the prompt was go into a community of oppressed people and invite them to create a quick script, a one-act play, and then act it in front of their community, showing how somebody in their community is being oppressed, whether it's a man beating a woman or if it's the government taking from the people or whatever it was. And then they perform the one-act play where there's clearly somebody who is oppressed. And these are just people who aren't actors or anything. And then afterwards, but they don't make any declaration or anything, but after the play, then the audience then comments on what was the oppressed. And then they come up with a solution to what would be the ideal opposite of that, where the person wasn't oppressed. I've seen that done in so many ways. And
there was one where the audience did get to rewrite the script.
Yeah,
and then
the
director got mad at them about it. So it sounds like it actually is like a classic version of that.
I love that crew.
I bring up this story because, and where I want to land the conversation is, does it have to be transformative? Does it have to have social commentary? When we look at these shenanigans, I mean, doing things just for fun is fun. We like things just for fun. Are we trying to transform people? Are we trying to change people? We're both friends with Benja Juster, who you mentioned earlier on the show.
Yeah.
And he's very into social commentary and putting people in humorous situations that will lead them to uncomfortable conversations they wouldn't have otherwise. He's very much that way as an artist. And I guess it's kind of like it's art. So it's like whatever you want to do as an artist, if you are trying to push a certain narrative or not, or you're trying to create transformation. But from your perspective as someone who's curated so much and has mentored so many artists, what are the goals of shenanigans, and how do you know if you've executed one successfully?
Well, generally, they will tell you. there's a resounding, you know, we used to say, like, you can shoot for awesome, but you can't really define it. But everybody knows when it was awesome. And that's, again, key ingredients, all the things mixed together. Yeah, hopefully so. God damn it. I think that it resonates more when it is relatable and pushing a boundary or making a statement of something. So you can clearly have things that are just hilarious and fun. I don't want to just do those. I want you to walk away thinking different about the world. I want you to walk away thinking differently about yourself. And whether that is done via a circus or done via a chapel, I don't care. All these characters and everything, I know they all want that too. And I think that's also why it becomes more meaningful. You know, and sometimes that can just be a simple gesture of, hey, let's all get up and hug. And after we did this funny thing, and now suddenly we have this moment and this intimate thing, thinking of Super Tall Paul and his family photo that he does all the time. And also, I think that in a world of artificial bullshit everything, real meaningful anything is just what people are craving so much. And these are all just vehicles to bring us together. And what people want to be done is brought together and have a shared something. And we live in this fringe world of festival and gatherings and community that we take never for granted, I hope. I don't, but and never lightly. Like, we are radically doing stuff that others will talk about years from now, is how I've always felt. We are those people. We are the ones doing this. You know, we are in a tiny little microcosm minority when so much of the world is mainstream, blah, blah. And that's why it becomes so more potent, though, if somebody comes upon it and experiences it, because, wow, you haven't really experienced anything real in that way. Because even church and religion is a goddamn show, you know? So if it's funny, the reason it's funny is often because it's true. And the greatest of comedians, the greatest of shenanigan puller offers are the ones who can find that relatable thing, that little nugget, and present it in this slightly different light and sound and presentation costume. But they can create that container and somebody can go inside it and go, huh, I never thought of it that way. And what I've always said is that when you have that one little kind of hit, that tip, then it becomes more possible that you could get another one. And so then you might be more open to go to the workshop on Tantra or composting or colonizing. You might be more open to hear that message that you weren't going to because you were cracked open. And I think when you talk about transformation and integration, which you can't have really one or the other, you have to have those things. That is the process. And if you are so lucky to be in a place where something that you experienced had a profound effect in that moment, then you probably are going to seek that out again.
And maybe the funnel takes you all the way to when you want to start making them yourself. That's the, you get cracked open, you start getting the itch. You want to go have more experiences. You want to feel more authentic connection, because it's so interesting how within sometimes these entirely contrived spaces, because they push you out of your comfort zone, all of a sudden you're vulnerable and you're able to speak vulnerably. And and that ends up, you end up wanting more and more of that. And I think that you alluded to kind of a Bay Area experience design community. That's that crew. They all got turned on as you did when you first went to Burning Man in 1995. And then they're like, let me show you this cool thing. Let me show you this cool thing. Hey, can I borrow the guy on your team who did that cool thing? Because we got to do a cool thing. And the only person who can do it is that guy. And it's okay, but we're going to swap him for the woman who did that amazing performance. And that gets us to the real juice of everything to me, which is community.
Absolutely.
Which is these networks of deep connection where someone has had your back, where you've thrived by striving together. And we're all craving that. That's why we go to a festival in the first place. We want to feel connection. We want to be a part of something. We want to experience art, but we could experience art by ourselves. We go to a place and we pay money, and sometimes we wait in long lines or whatever. And it's not so that we can have a passive experience in a like kind of corporate presented Disneyland kind of thing. We go because we want to feel alive and we want to feel together. And I think that experienced designers, those warlocks of shenanigans, as, such as you, sir, are absolutely foundational to that, which is why I wanted to have you on the show. And and just for the audience, part of why we're doing this, by the way, is I'm writing about this in my book. And of course, the person who I would talk to about this is Tyler. And I was like, Tyler, I need to talk to you about what I'm doing in my book. And then it was like, oh, this is so obvious that we need to do a podcast, because everybody should get this, because you're only going to get, you're only going to get like a 2 pages of this in the book. So let's do. So
with
all
that
being said, Tyler Hanson. With that little promo for my Tyler, what are you working on now? How can we follow your material? How can we get involved in what you're doing? And for any experienced designers or aspiring experienced designers, how could they connect with you and with the people that you are involved working with?
Awesome. Thank you for saying so much. One final note on this, like all of that shenanigans and everything. What happens is that you get permission. And permission is the thing that we're missing so much in society. Permission to do it. Yes, you can too. That's what Burning Man gives
Doctor
you.
Doctor permission.
Doctor
promise and Mr. Permission. I don't
know. Something like that.
Little Miss Permission. How about that? Yeah. Little Miss Permission.
The latest project that I'm working on, one, United Refuge, which is all about taking our production skills and turning that into good for how we're going to deal with the coming challenges and changes of this world that we live in, and specifically on how we take care of people who are being displaced by flood, famine, war, climate, etc. UnitedRefuge.org. And the other thing that we are launching is Peak Immersive, peakimmersive.com. And basically what we are hyper-focused on is how do you build community? So we want to be community consultants. What are the key ingredients to community? And how do you go about doing that? This is something that I see as the big need inside of anything that's lifting up and starting or anything that's trying to sustain. It's really challenging. And there are key ingredients to that if you're going to try and build a community. What the hell is a community? Who's the community? Am I the community? Are you the community? Where's the my community? I'm looking for community. We can help you understand that. So that's the main focus. And other than that, just taking care of my lovely lady who is a nurse, Galen Dorian. Shout out. I love you so much. And that is actually my life mission.
Good man shouts out his partner on the podcast. You're like the only person who's ever done that. That's hot.
I love her so much. And I am nothing without her. And I am so grateful that I got to be here with you in this early morning and late afternoon in Abida via Reno.
Tyler, I appreciate you so much. You know so much. You were the perfect person to do this. And I'm so happy to finally get you on Life is a Festival.
I am too. It worked out. Thank you so much, my brother.
thank you for joining us for Life is a Festival. If you liked the show, you can support it by sharing it with your friends, following it on Spotify, or reviewing it on iTunes. If you'd like to get more involved, you can join our Facebook group, Life is a Festival, where we talk about the show and you can suggest new guests. If you really liked the show and maybe want a little bit more, visit my digital tip jar at patreon.com/lifeisafestival.com. Whatever you do, I hope today's podcast helped you make your life just a little bit more like a festival, and I'll see you on the dance floor.